This morning, United States versus Vallejo. Ms. Altman?
Thank you, Judge. Good morning. May it please the Court, Ms. Hamilton. My name is Stephen Saltzman, and I represent the defendant appellant, Jose Vallejo. The crux of this appeal is whether, in following the Mattia case, the district court thought that the sentencing decision was still determined by the guidelines unless rare circumstances existed, like those of a departure, which, as the court knows, in the pre-Booker law, were extremely limited and difficult to explain.
Well, I would say, reading your opening brief, the question is whether Judge Kaur correctly assumed that he himself could not give a sentence outside the guidelines unless the defendant before him came in and rebutted the presumption that the guidelines create a reasonable sentence, or, as you put it in your appellate brief, whether under McKeetiuk, that's a standard of appellate review. You know, that the district judge computes the guidelines, the district judge takes the 3553A factors into account as he or she wishes, comes up with a sentence that the district judge is happy with, and then on appeal, if the district judge has selected a guideline sentence, we presume that to be reasonable. If the district judge has selected a non-guideline sentence under Dean, we look and see why.
That's correct, Judge, and I agree that Judge Kaur thought that, and I never can pronounce this right, Matiak told him that his discretion was very limited. And I think that's the issue. I think he says it in very straightforward language. I understand the Seventh Circuit in Matiak is saying you give a lot of weight to the guidelines, so much weight that unless the defendant can rebut the presumption of reasonableness under the guidelines, then you give a guideline sentence. Is that giving too much deference to the guidelines after Booker? Perhaps, but I think that is what the Seventh Circuit told us in Matiak. And then he went on to say that it was going to be difficult to get around that presumption because the Seventh Circuit, in effect, said you give great weight by virtue of this presumption to the guidelines. That's at page 18 of the sentencing transcript, Judge.
Right.
Judge Breyer's opinion in Booker and the statute don't talk of reasonableness only as a standard of appellate review. There's no mention of the presumption of reasonableness of the guideline sentence as a district court issue in his opinion or in 3553A. Most of the other circuits have rejected the use of this presumption of reasonableness as a standard in the district court. Now, I think, Judge, that I know that this court has continued to cite and refer to that, to Matiak and the rebuttable presumption, although I think it's done so in different ways that I believe send a different message to the district court. And one of the problems that I believe exists in the original formulation is the court said to district court judges, the standard is reasonableness, the guidelines are presumed to be reasonable, and it will be a rare sentence, guideline sentence, that's unreasonable.
Well, what we said that we would find to be unreasonable.
Well, okay.
The word "we" is in there.
Yes, Judge, and that's what I think that is in fact what the court has said subsequently. I think when we look at the Walker case, it says a sentencing court applying Booker now consults the guidelines as guidance for what is a wholly discretionary decision, discretion that is exercised by reference to the broad array of sentencing factors set forth in 3553 in section 3553A, and then it goes on and it cites Matiak, but it does so in a way that sets it up as the rareness or the presumption as more of an appellate standard, Judge, and I think that's also true in Reuter. So I think the court in other cases has made clear that the district court does have the discretion, and I think Judge Kaur, looking only at that case, really cabined his discretion, and I think his statement is very forthright and very clear about that.
Now, is there any reason to think, the government, as I understand it, may be arguing the alternative, that even if McKeetiuk means that even if Judge Kaur misread McKeedian, I'll put it that way, and thought that what was an appellate standard was also a district court standard, he nonetheless concluded that this was a reasonable sentence for your client, Mr. Vallejo. What should we do with that? Because, of course, in the end, it's results that we review.
I think this is the situation that the court recently described in Mancari, where the court said, having reviewed the sentencing transcript in its entirety, it is unclear to us whether the district court properly took its post-Booker discretion into account. This court said it appears that the district court to have been under the misimpression that its discretion was still cabined by the pre-Booker departure jurisprudence. I think that's what happened here. Judge Kaur thought that it was really an extraordinary situation. It had to be an extraordinary situation to let him go outside the guidelines, that the guidelines still really controlled. And so I think that case is right on point in answering that question. And unlike in the Hankston and Davis case, where a lawyer is asserting that that's what the district court said, here we have a very clear record, I think, a very clear statement from the judge as to what he understood Matiak to mean. So for that reason, I think it's the same kind of situation as the court found in Cunningham, where the court said we have to satisfy ourselves before we conclude that the judge did not abuse his discretion, that he exercised his discretion. And I think we can't be satisfied that that's true here. And in fact, it really appears that Judge Kaur did not understand the full exercise of his discretion, as I think this court has made clear in many other opinions since Matiak. I want to also, and other circuits have found the same concerns and tried to address them. The First Circuit has made clear that the district court, that presumption of reasonableness is not the standard for the district court, that the guidelines are generalizations, that there are certainly times when district courts can find that those generalizations don't pertain to a particular case. The Sixth Circuit has said similarly and has focused on the principle that starts 3553A, that the court shall impose a sentence sufficient but not more than necessary to provide punishment, promote respect for the law, take the seriousness of the offense into account, achieve deterrence, and satisfy rehabilitation needs. And I think that is the guideline that really has to guide the district courts. And it's not to say that the guidelines don't have any importance. I mean, as one court I think has said, you have these pretty broad factors, and the guidelines give you a number. So it's the starting point. And I think the word that the court used in Hankston and Davis is an important one. This court said there it's a benchmark. And I really think that's pretty close to saying it's a starting point, and then you have to go further and consider these factors and see what's the appropriate sentence under these factors, taking into account the sufficient but not more than necessary language.
Well, your estimate is, and obviously you're going to get a different sentence if you go back.
I'm going to try, Judge. I think there are positives in Mr. Vallejo. Mr. Vallejo made a very compelling statement, and he has done things to try to change his life, including while he's been in prison. And I think when given a chance when Judge Kaur has a chance to fully understand, to fully appreciate his discretion, that will make a difference. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, Judge.
Ms. Hamilton?
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Saltzman, Carrie Hamilton on behalf of the United States. The district court did not commit error by sentencing the defendant to the low end of his guideline range.
But maybe, Ms. Hamilton, you could start where Mr. Saltzman was, because we certainly, as you know, have remanded legions of cases in which we felt that the district court did not fully appreciate the way the places where the guidelines need to be taken into account and, at the same time, the scope of the district court's discretion. And here, the court basically saying he himself couldn't give a non-guideline sentence until a defendant had rebutted a presumption of reasonableness, expresses a view of what the McKeediuk decision said that's in some tension with the language of that opinion.
But in sum and substance, what he did at sentencing is what this court has recently said he should do in Hankton, which he started with the guideline range.
But if he placed too high a burden on the defendant to go outside the guidelines, then we don't know whether he might have weighed those factors differently. You're right. He very conscientiously goes through, you know, capital A, capital B, capital C. He talks about everything. But if he does it in the wrong analytical structure, we don't know if he would come out the same way again.
I think he would come out the same way again because...
Well, I mean, I'm sure the government will argue for it, but it how do you know? I mean, if he has the wrong legal structure...
Because in part, what he said wasn't, Mr. Saltzman, you make very good points. I understand everything that you're saying, but you just haven't rebutted the presumption. What he did was find that the arguments before him were not cogent factors that were such that he should give a guideline or a sentence lower than the low end of the guideline range.
But I don't read it that way. He says the way you rebut it, the way you rebut it, this is on page 16 of his transcript, is to demonstrate unreasonableness of the guideline sentence. In the absence of that, then you go with the guideline sentence. Now, if that's wrong, then he has started at the wrong place and you don't know where he would have ended up. And certainly our cases are recognize that there isn't a singular reasonable sentence out there in the world. We've said as long as the district judge picked a reasonable sentence, that's fine, but it needs to be done the right way.
And I think that you can tell it was done in the right way by how he goes through the factors.
But that's before the sentence that I just read. The sentence that I just read is right toward the end of his analysis. And if he had said, you know, once I calculate the guideline range, it's now a wholly discretionary decision, as we indicated in Walker, or I understand, you know, we said in Reuter, the judge is cabined but also liberated by the statutory sentencing factors. If he said anything sounding like that, I would have no problem, but
there
he doesn't.
There is a point in the sentencing when he recognizes that it's wholly discretionary. And at the very end, right before he actually imposes the sentence, Judge Kaur reiterates his issues with this defendant and specific deterrence, which is consistent with what he did when he went through the factors.
Right before that, he says, and until the Seventh Circuit changes its mind, it's going to be difficult to get around that presumption. I don't know what presumption he's talking about that applies to him.
I believe he's talking about the presumption that the guideline range is reasonable.
But that would be true once a district court has looked at everything and has concluded in the final analysis that the guidelines provide the appropriate sentence. That doesn't necessarily mean that the district judge isn't entitled to look at everything.
And I believe that he did. We know that he did because he allowed defense counsel to make arguments and he considered them.
But he does with a great big thumb on the guideline scale, which, of course, is what the government has been arguing for nonstop since Booker was decided. But what if that thumb doesn't belong there? What if he's supposed to take the guidelines and just weigh it along with everything else once he's properly computed it and understands what sentence the guidelines recommend as a starting point? A recommendation as a starting point is different from something that's the presumption that you're going to have that sentence, which can then only be set aside if you come up with something so powerful that you have to push it off the table.
But that's not the way that he talks about the arguments that were presented to him. He doesn't say, I understand what you're saying, but it doesn't cut it because there's a rebuttable presumption.
Boy, I sure read him as saying exactly what you just said.
What he says is that past behavior is indicative of future behavior. And he talks about the fact that his prior convictions were for crimes of violence.
But
and
that's
that
within
offense
the
conduct
guideline structure. He's talking there very specifically about whether criminal history is overrepresented. And
right.
And he says, no, criminal history, that's one little guideline factor. It's also a general factor.
But he also talks about that in his analysis of specific deterrence and general deterrence. And he does that in disregarding and not crediting the defendant's argument that 190 months is good enough. He talks about the fact that it would be one thing if we didn't have this recurring problem, but we do have a recurring problem of violence in this defendant. And he specifically says, under these circumstances, that he's going to reimpose the guideline or the sentencing, the sentence he did before. And I take that to mean that he was listening. He was considering all the factors before him.
Oh, he's a wonderful judge. I'm sure he listened to everything very carefully, and he was trying to go through the structure the way he should have. But if there's ambiguity in an opinion that we've written, or actually the court, you know, we have lots of supplemental authority, if our court's opinions have not been providing clear guidance in one direction or the other, to the district courts, we ought to clarify it.
But I think,
did he have a reasonableness discussion in his thinking?
Did he have a reasonableness?
Should he? Should he consider reasonableness as an issue with regard to the sentence he imposed?
Yes, he should. Absolutely. The idea is that he's supposed to come up with a sentence that's reasonable, that he believes is reasonable, recognizing that the government may say one sentence is reasonable, and defendant is going to say or may say that another sentence is reasonable. And in this case, he specifically found
that determination whether it's reasonable or not is one for us and not for district court, right? It's an issue on appeal whether it's reasonable or not. Is it an issue for the district court to make a determination that there's a rebutting a presumption of reasonableness?
I believe that's basically what's happening now, right?
But it's never mentioned. I mean, I think what Judge Kaney is alluding to is the fact that 3553A itself doesn't say anything about pick a reasonable sentence. It has all these specific points.
Right. But, I mean, that's really the upshot of what is happening.
Well, that's what the problem is. I mean, and I think that's a problem for district judges. Maybe you're right, but we haven't said that.
Shouldn't we tell them? We want you to explicitly find that your sentence is reasonable. Consider the guidelines, but nevertheless come to the conclusion that with or without the guidelines, the sentence is reasonable.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that that's being construed as what you said anyway.
Well, I was gonna say, shouldn't we say to the district court, you should say specifically that even considering the guidelines and everything else, that this, in your opinion, is a reasonable sentence, and why?
Yes.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, the government asks that you affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Salzman?
Judge, I'll waive my time unless the court has specific questions.
There wasn't that much time anyway, so you didn't lose it.
No, I'm sorry.
We appreciate that, however, that you have waived. Thank you very much.